Good afternoon, everyone. Happy Wednesday, the 7th day of September, 2022. I'm Hank Jones, and you are listening to Hank Jones Polysports here at Global Patriot Radio, where we can be found on blogtalkradio.com. Again, I am Hank Jones, and why not? Sort of like Here Lies David St. Hubbins, and why not? Every Wednesday at 5:30, I am here bringing you politics, sports, when they combine, when they crash, when they collide, et cetera, here at Global Patriot Radio, where we have a show every day, 7 days a week, seven shows a week. Starting out Mondays, Vito Esposito and Big Al with the Vito Esposito Show featuring Big Al. That goes at 6 o'clock Eastern time on Monday. Tuesdays at 6 Eastern, Eric is in with the Cross and Crescent discussion. Wednesdays, of course, me, Hank Jones, 5:30 p.m. with Hank Jones Polysports. And then Thursdays, Paul Sutliff comes in at 6 Eastern with the Sutliffian Report. Fridays, usually around noon, Andrew Herod with Conservative Casual Friday. And then Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight, Minister Usama Dakduk and the Beautiful Christie revealing the truth about Islam. Then 3 p.m. Eastern time every Sunday, Eric is back for the second time in the week with Real Interfaith Dialogue, a continuation of the Cross and Crescent discussion. That's the one you have to get the app for, download an app. He doesn't like you just come in and sling mud, so to speak. And there's other shows, too, on blogtalkradio.com. Annie with Southern Sense Radio, Joseph Gibson, Understanding the Times in Which We Live, Chief with the Simple Things in Life, Tim Tapp, Tap Into Truth, Dave and G-Ski with the Dave and G-Ski Rocks show. All good shows, check them out. Come into Blog Talk Radio. And of course, when you come in, always look to see what's happening with Global Patriot Radio. Easiest way to do it, of course, is to log in, click on the live button, and it'll tell you if we're on right then or not. But you can listen to our shows anytime. You can listen to them in an archived format, sort of like a podcast, I guess. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. I am here in Electric Hankland with my little mini Aussie, and my wife is back. She was in Ohio dealing with some mom medical issues. Please pray for her and for my wife and her brother and families as they deal with that. It's sort of working toward an end of life phase. Anyway, things are great here in Acoustic Hankland and Electric Hankland. And of course, it's hot here in Florida. Hot, 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 as they say. Okay, let us get to some recent obituaries. Last Tuesday, actually August 30th, I can't believe I missed it last week. We lost former American shot putter George Woods, the age of 79. He won silver medals in the shot put in the 1968 and 1972 Olympics. I'll talk about the 72 Olympics later. He finished seventh in 1976, having won the U.S. Olympic trials. He actually held the indoor record of 72 feet 3 inches, which he set in 1974, held it for 11 years. At the time, he was often overshadowed by Brian Oldfield. Remember, Oldfield had turned professional. He was on that superstar show multiple times. Oldfield had multiple throws over 73 feet, including a throw of 75 feet even in one of those professional meets. Make no mistake, though, he was the best. George Woods was the best amateur shot thrower of his era. Last Thursday, we lost former American boxer Ernie Shavers, age 78, after a short illness. Ernie Shavers fought off and on from 1969 to 1995. He had wins over such heavyweights as one-time contender Jimmy Young, former WBA champ Jimmy Ellis, Joe Bugner, former heavyweight champ Ken Norton. He had three unsuccessful title fights, one against Muhammad Ali and two against Larry Holmes. Now, many observers felt Shavers should have been given the decision in the Ali fight. And in his second fight with Holmes, he knocked Larry Holmes down in the seventh round before he was stopped on a TKO in the 11th. Larry Holmes actually said Shavers was the hardest puncher he ever fought. Friday, we lost drummer, musician, and songwriter Drummy Zeb of the English reggae group Aswad. At age 62, no cause listed. Aswad originally did the song Don't Turn Around prior to the song's bastardization by the pop group Ace of Base in 1994. Ironically, Drummy Zeb was the producer for Ace of Base at the time. And we also lost astronomer and astrophysicist Frank Drake at age 92. Frank Drake designed what is called the Arecibo message. It was an intergalactic radio message sent to a cluster of stars back in 1974. The message basically outlined Earth and humanity up to that point and was meant to show our technological achievement. He also created the Drake equation, which defined probabilities of communicative extraterrestrial civilizations within the Milky Way. Friday, we lost also billionaire businessman and golf enthusiast Herb Kohler at age 83. He was the CEO of Kohler Company, family manufacturing business in Kohler, Wisconsin. I have several Kohler plumbing fixtures myself. Kohler also owned the Old Course Hotel at Scotland's famed St. Andrews Golf Course. There's also a Mount Kohler in Antarctica named after Kohler and his sister. And then Saturday, we lost writer Peter Straub. He was the author of Ghost Story and among others, to complications following hip surgery at age 79. Other books included Julia and the Talisman. We also lost Bed Bath & Beyond CFO Gustavo Arnal to suicide at age 52. The company had recently announced a large set of layoffs along with 150 store closures. He jumped to his death from what is commonly called the Jenga building in New York City. Then we also lost former Soviet boxer Boris Lagutin at age 84. He was the Olympic bronze medalist in 1960. And then the gold medalist in both 1964 and 1968 in the light middleweight division. Yesterday we lost former player and football player and coach Hal Morris. Complications of Alzheimer's at age 71. He played for both the Philadelphia Eagles and New England Patriots in the NFL. He later served as the head coach at Kentucky. There was a game in 2002 where Kentucky got what appeared to be a game-winning field goal with 11 seconds left. He was doused in a Gatorade bath by quarterback Jared Lorenzen. And then LSU subsequently won the game on an 80-yard Hail Mary pass as time expired. So, yeah, don't be tossing around the Gatorade. Buzzer sounds. Yeah, it was that was it for notable obituaries this week. Anyway, hey, don't forget my friends at Lions Communications, Central Florida's 24-hour call center and messaging center services for your clinic, hospital, service company, information gathering projects. Hospital, government, service company, or otherwise, they get the job done. And don't forget, they can also work with remote staff. Give them a call, 800-555-3738, or visit them on the web at alliancecommunications.com. Got a quick internet laughy here from the Babylon Bee. Biden abolishes office of the president and names himself Supreme Fuhrer. Actually, that isn't so funny, is it? Seeing as it hits pretty close to the truth. Pretty darn close. Really no quickies this week. Yeah, just, you know, the usual elections and primaries and stuff going on. A Trump endorsee took the primary for the Republican primary for Massachusetts governor. It's always amazing when Massachusetts doesn't elect a Democrat to any given office. That's for darn sure. But it's true. They have elected Republicans there. I don't know how it happens. Let's get to the news and notes and idiocy and crap and other interesting stuff. Very sad story from USA Today that I picked up on Yahoo. Now, it tells the story of a 71-year-old black woman named Lizzie Pugh. Now, Lizzie Pugh lives near Detroit. She went on a church-sponsored gambling junket near Detroit back in April. I know. I know how that sounds. But only in Detroit do you see churches organizing casino outings. So, you know, let's leave that there. Anyway, Lizzie Pugh won a five-figure slot machine jackpot on that outing. Now, she opted to pay her taxes at the casino, in other words, have them withheld from the winnings and credited to that tax payment. And then she was issued some cash and a rather nice-sized check. Far so good, no? But then it gets sad and bad. Lizzie Pugh went to a Fifth Third Bank in Livonia, Michigan. She planned to deposit the check by opening a savings account at the bank. The problem, apparently, three white bank employees each refused to open the account or deposit the check. They told Lizzie Pugh the check was fraudulent. Now, bear in mind, the check had the logo and account numbers for the casino. It had Lizzie Pugh's name and address, which matched her driver's license, on the check. It also gave the reason for the payment, i.e. it said slots jackpot. She was asked where she worked. She had no problem explaining she is retired. And the employee left the office where they had taken her to talk. The employee returned saying the check was fraudulent. As you can imagine, she was concerned. A second bank employee was summoned and not only made the fraudulent claim, but also refused to return the check back to Lizzie Pugh. A third bank employee, presumably a higher up, reiterated the fraud claim and the bank's refusal to return the check to Ms. Pugh. Now, she told the bank she was not leaving without the check. She eventually was able to leave with the check and proceeded to a nearby Chase Bank, which deposited the check. It cleared the following day. Now, Lizzie Pugh was going to let this slide. Now, thank God for her niece convinced her to fight this and helped Lizzie Pugh file a lawsuit in federal court, got an attorney to file the lawsuit. But think about this from both a racial and global perspective. Now, we see big media lionize people like George Floyd, Michael Brown, or even Colin Kaepernick, in many cases, not only is racism proven not to be present, but it ends up setting back race relations and general unity in this country by several decades. But in this case, we have a woman who not only did nothing wrong or fraudulent, but she also wanted to give business to a bank. Now, she wasn't asking to cash the check. She wasn't trying to write checks against her winnings. She simply wanted to open a savings account. Now, I'm not even going to go into all the various options available for the bank to check on the validity of the check, or should I say to verify the validity of the check. This bank dumped all over her, presumably because they couldn't quite believe a black woman would have a five-figure check or was incapable of opening a savings account. Fine, they're morons. You didn't need me to make that point. But now, think globally. Ask yourself, I don't care if you're white, black, brown, yellow, whatever, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, or whatever. Ask yourself, how would you feel if they did this to your 71-year-old aunt, mother, sister, or even friend? How would you feel to be presumed to be committing fraud simply by requesting to open a bank account or deposit a check? It would suck, right? Of course it would. But now, understand, please, that there is racism in our country. No, I'm not talking about cops looking to kill each and every minority they encounter. Not NFL teams looking for a quarterback who can actually make all the plays, read all the coverages, make all the throws, and call all the audibles versus just doing a tuck and run. Kaepernick. Not bakeries wanting to stick to their religious principles, but banks. You know, I was telling Brother Tommy a couple weeks ago about a guy who did a kayak tour with me at my new avocation of working for a paddle touring company. The guy and his female companion, they sucked. They couldn't paddle straight. They damn near had to be leashed and dragged across the water with the wind, by the way. But, of course, they wanted a refund the following day. He intimated that he would smear the company on social media. So I did a deep dive. It ain't hard, by the way. So what did I find? This guy, who turns out to be a banker, is a serial complainer and reviewer on the internet. He hasn't posted much on social media, but yeah, he uses the threat of doing so. But this guy, banker making threats. Look, in general, most people that work in the banking industry are regular people. But as an industry, the leadership and management have about as much integrity as your average Department of Justice admin or mid to upper level FBI agent. No, racism isn't the problem it once was. But it still exists. And it still happens in such stalwart places as banks, sports, and the DNC. But just poor woman, alone, 71 years old, she wins at a casino. She goes in and the bank, I mean, do you realize how many different ways a bank could have checked the validity of this? How many different ways they had to verify that these funds were there, that this woman, Lizzie Pugh, actually won this jackpot? You know, you see articles that the black community doesn't trust banks by and large. Well, no shit. There's a good reason why. I mean, I don't trust banks. I think I consider them a necessary evil. Trust them. You know, as an industry, these people are money launderers. If it was safe to keep shoeboxes under your bed, it would be a better alternative. I mean, the financial industry as a whole, look what they have done in terms of making it near impossible for you to save money the conventional way and earn money on that savings. You know, before a dollar ever gets to you, banker who has money passed through, they can loan out $9 on the every dollar they get into that. I mean, it's a racket. It has become a racket. But this poor woman. So before we start going feeling sorry for people that get killed in a shoot-up with cops or somebody who's whining because he lost his starting job. Think about this poor woman who basically had nobody to speak for her until after the fact. She just went in to innocently open a safe. I mean, she was opening an account. It's not like she was going in there wanting cash or wanting to write checks against this. She wanted to use the proceeds from winning this slot jackpot at a casino, which, by the way, has more morality and integrity than a friggin' bank. Gambling is, for all intents and purposes, immoral. But this bank treated this woman like that. I mean, they it was so bad that she didn't want to do anything about it because she just didn't want to keep dredging it up. Thank God for her niece for pushing this. I hope they drag it through. I don't want to see a settlement with Fifth Third. I want them to say, we suck. We suck at this. And I want it to come out that why we shouldn't just trust banks because they have big buildings on the corner in our towns. Look, I'm not anti-bank. I'm not anti-money. It's not what I'm saying. But I'm saying the leadership of these institutions is friggin' questionable, real questionable. And these are the people that support people like Dopey Joe and La Dopey Nostra. This Reuters story also appeared on Yahoo. Evidently, United Airlines has told the FAA that if it doesn't get more flight authorizations, they will have to suspend service to New York City's JFK Airport. Think about that for a second. Basically, it threatened to drop JFK service if the U.S. does not approve more flights. They said on Tuesday they plan to end service in October. They're not planning. United Chief Executive Scott Kirby wrote to the acting FAA Administrator Billy Nolen last week. And where's Mayor Pete on this, our Secretary of Transportation? Urged him to increase capacity at JFK. They're flying just twice daily to San Francisco and Los Angeles. Think about that. From JFK, the busiest New York airport. Says if we're not able to get additional allocations for multiple seasons, we will need to suspend service at JFK effective at the end of October. The FAA said it must, quote, consider airspace capacity and runway capacity to assess how changes would affect flights at nearby airports. Any additional slots at JFK would follow the FAA's well-established process of awarding them fairly and to increase competition. Now, these are takeoff and landing authorizations. I mean, how can they grow to be more competitive? Two frigging flights a day? Yeah, you're darn right they can't effectively serve JFK. When you have other airlines that have a lot larger schedules and a lot more attractive flight times. Now, they struck a deal, United did, in 2015, to lease 24 year-round slots at JFK to Delta as it ended JFK service to concentrate at its nearby Newark hub. Now, they argue that there is room to grow at JFK. It's the 13th busiest U.S. airport because since 2008, the Port Authority and FAA have made significant infrastructure investments, including the widening of runways, construction of multi-entrance taxiways, and the creation of aligned high-speed turnoffs. In June, the FAA approved United's request to temporarily cut about 50 daily summer departures from its new Newark airport hub to address congestion, representing 12% of their daily flights at Newark. They are the dominant carrier there, operating about 69 flights. Think about that. To get more flights, they have to give up flights elsewhere. Think about that. I mean, you have to like broker flights. I mean, what the hell is our FAA doing? If they're turning it into a zero-sum game, like in other words, in order to get more flights one place, you have to cut flights somewhere else. Why? If they have the capacity to increase flight traffic, which presumably would reduce backups, backlogs, canceled flights, if they have the capacity to do that, why isn't the FAA jumping up and down, arms open wide? I mean, what the hell? I mean, look, people say, oh, United's threatening. Yeah, you're damn right. I think they're being awfully kind, letting it play out until October. Put it this way. I'm going to give you an example of my new career. I guide paddleboard tours. That's not just paddleboards. It's paddleboards and kayaks. I live in Central Florida near Orlando. I do most of my tours out at by Cape Canaveral on the Intercoastal Waterway. It's for bioluminescence. It's not hard to look it up. It's basically a glow that you see in the water due to the algae bloom interacting with plankton, dinoflagellates, and you see a glow in the water as your paddle runs through, as you kick your legs or run your hands through it, as you see fish, as you see dolphins and manatees. Yes, I do. I've only seen one manatee. But I've seen a ton of dolphins. So, you know, I'm driving a trailer of, you know, our company's based in Orlando. It's not my company. I'm just a lowly employee. But, you know, our company's based here in Orlando. We're not big enough to just have boards all over the place, let alone the space to store them and all that stuff. So I pick up a truck, pickup truck or an SUV with a trailer, and I lug boards and kayaks over to the coast. Fine so far, right? Now, would I do that if there was just one person signed up for a tour? Routinely, if it was every night just one person signed up for a tour, it wouldn't be economically feasible for the owners of this company to do that. It would be stupid of them to send me out there every day to do that. Which is why we allow for up to 30 vessels on a tour. Now, granted, as you get into higher numbers, we need more than one guide, but that's a whole other matter. But my point being, if we needed 20 guides, we wouldn't do it either. Now, the city where we do that, it's actually the city of Titusville, allows us to have one guide per 20 vessels. That's insanity. I could explain that all day, but that's insanity. I wouldn't take a tour because these are at night. You have to see this at night. I wouldn't take a group of 20 vessels out at night by myself. Hell no. But so you understand the problem. I mean, it's, you know, if you are serving one person a day at your McDonald's and you have a McDonald's down the street, you're not going to open a third McDonald's. You're going to try and consolidate things into the two McDonald's, aren't you? And maybe make that one McDonald's. If you're getting 50 people coming through the drive-through at one and one a day at the other, well, something's going to happen at the other. It's going to lose money because you're having people that are staffing it from whenever to whenever. A lot of McDonald's are now 24 hours, by the way, at their drive-thrus. Well, they can't sustain that. It's the same thing. United can't sustain having two flights a day out of JFK. For the logistics of the staff there at their ticketing counters and at their boarding areas, and I mean, they can't do it. Especially since there probably have to be windows on either side of those to accommodate potential delays or whatever. And yet these airlines get in trouble when they cancel flights. They get in trouble from the FAA and the Department of Transportation canceling flights. Yeah, I mean, idiocy, idiocy. Moving on, Coy Griffin. He's the Otero County, New Mexico commissioner, county commissioner, who was convicted by a judge for his part in the January 6, 2021 Capitol incident. He has been disqualified, barred by a judge from holding any further office, and removed from his position as county commissioner. Now, the judge, State District Court Judge Francis Matthew, noted that he partook in no violence. That although he partook in no violence, Griffin did take an oath of office to support and defend the Constitution. And in entering the Capitol grounds, he delayed the certification of the presidential election by Congress and thus violated his oath. The irony? The request was made in part by nonprofit Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, a.k.a. CREW. The co-founders. Who are the co-founders? Melanie Sloan, whose past employment has included stints with John Conyers and Chuck E. Schumer. And the other co-founder, Norm Eisen, who recently served as co-counsel for the House Judiciary Committee during the first impeachment and trial of President Trump. Other heads of the group, noted liberals David Brock, Richard Painter. Past watchdog reports by the group have named 63 Republicans and just 25 Democrats. Gee, yeah, that seems unbiased to me. And a nonprofit, no less. You get what I'm saying about a nonprofit. I know there are nonprofits that quote-unquote lobby, but they are not supposed to. Nonprofits aren't supposed to be political at all. They're supposed to be neutral. They're not supposed to advocate. Now, they set them up and they pretend not to advocate. or if they are, you know, registered political groups, that's one thing. But in this case, calling itself a watchdog, clearly not the case. Important news from La Dopey Nostra. Last Thursday's speech, puppeted by Barack Obama via Dopey Joe, was not political or politicizing. They said so, despite the following. Here's what came from the speech. Citing MAGA Republicans as a threat to America and democracy. Nothing political there. Speaking from the grounds of a U.S. national park. Direct criticism aim of same at his predecessor, who is still a political opponent. The presence of the U.S. Marine Band. Being flanked by members of the U.S. Marines. The very fact that he mentioned no accomplishments, even the kind that La Dopey Nostra makes up and pretends are accomplishments, as part of his speech. No accomplishments mentioned as part of his speech. No economic news or solutions. No comments on immigration, national security, greenhouse gases, or anything of actual substance. The speech was 100% aimed at attacking President Trump, Trump supporters, and the very idea of what MAGA is about and for what it stands. But no, it wasn't political and wasn't politicizing anything. I mean, I finally watched replay of this. I did not watch this live. After talking to Hawkeye Mike last Friday, I thought I better give it a look-see. I mean, it was just absolutely repulsively and disgustingly partisan, political, and I mean, just a flat-out attack on a political opponent. And they're doubling down. La Dopey Nostra is doubling down and acting as if this was all above board and there's nothing wrong with it. I mean, the memes that you're seeing, Dopey Joe with a Fuhrer mustache, or Dopey Joe in, you know, galactic, you know, evil galactic, you know, the empire. All that. It's warranted. There's a reason that you're seeing it. I mean, for those that haven't seen it yet or haven't, you know, there's a reason that we're seeing this stuff. There's a reason that these are the kinds of responses elicited. This guy's whole speech was a political attack. Yeah. You know, for the first year and a half of President Trump's presidency, we kept hearing that he threatened to, you know, punish Hillary Clinton, and he's doing that, and he's trying to do that, and we've got to stop it. Really? He never did any such thing. Never said any such thing. He said if he had been president, she would be in jail. Points out, mentions in the speech 13 mentions of MAGA, 0 of inflation, 0 of crime, 0 of fentanyl, 0 of the border. You know, I mentioned last week that the minor leagues are working with Major League Baseball Players Association to unionize the minor leagues. Now, I'm going to tell you a lot of reasons that that's unlike, and I told you it's partly a reaction to the NIL in college and all that, which is, you know, that's a little bit of speculation, but I think I'm right. But there's more to it, okay, why it might not work. First, minor leaguers, it's not like, I mean, these are affiliates, you know, like when they say the Cubs, a minor league affiliate, the Cubs don't own that minor league affiliate. Somebody else owns that. There's an ownership group that owns that minor league baseball team. Now, in some cases, the home club might have a limited investment, but I believe they are not allowed to actually own their minor league teams outright. Indy or someone else. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. But be that as it may, guys move around too much. I mean, I know we're talking about in college football, the transfer portal and the unlimited transfers and all that. But think about it in the minor leagues, you literally get sent around. You can get up, get moved up, get moved down. You know, how does that compare? Are they going to have statutory minimums at each level? But even in various levels, there are multiple levels. There can be. For a lot of reasons. But here's the other thing. People say, well, unions are different now. Unions aren't all mobbed up. Teamsters isn't all mobbed up. International Longshoremen's isn't all mobbed up. Hotel employees and restaurant employees isn't all mobbed up. Well, theoretically, that's correct. But here's what happened with a lot of these unions, like the Teamsters. Government stepped in a lot of those cases. So rather than, Jimmy the Weasel, or no, here's a real, Anthony Tony Pro Provenzano, you now have some government schlub as the front. But you look at who the union leaders are and their lawyers and their leadership, and it's still a who's who of Democratic Party connections. One thing Democrats and liberals and progressives love is control. You know, you look at the ones who spoke out the most on behalf of college athletes and why they did. It was most of them threw like girls. They throw like Obama. They're not athletes. Some of them are, but most of them aren't. But they want that control. They want access to that money. They see the college football is billions of dollars. They see the Big Ten's getting billions of dollars in its latest media rights deal. And they salivate. Why? Not because they're such fans of the Big Ten, but access to that money. They don't care about earning it. Why should they? They never have before. So they salivate at that. So you look, just watch 5 years from now, what kind of names you're going to see in union, baseball union leadership. And I'm not talking about the player reps that get carted out on ESPN for statements. Those aren't the movers behind the scenes. Watch for names like Kamala Harris. Watch for names connected to a Hillary Clinton or a Barack Obama or a Chuck Schumer or a Jerry. I mean, watch for names like that. That's who your union leadership will be. No, it won't be some mobbed up member of the Gambino family. They have been moved around and moved out. Indy Hawk has posted a link in the forum, by the way, in the chat room. I believe it's Fauci throwing. I'm going to go take a look at this, folks, just in case that's what it is. Because if it is, it's in the chat room. You need to come in here. By the way, I forgot to mention, there are several ways to interact with our show. One of them is coming in live into the chat room. Yep. Oh, my God. Yeah, come into that link. You can come into the chat room. Come into blogtalkradio.com and come into the chat room. You can just listen online. You don't have to come into the chat room. You can just listen online, or you can call in. Now, if you're in the chat room, Indy Hawk is there right now with T. Bodie. In the phone lines, 319-527-6706. Sue from New Mexico was in earlier. I don't know where she went. My big sister's in. Hawkeye Mike's listening in. T. Bodie's listening in, too. He does that. He does both. He does double duty on these things. So it's pretty impressive. Listens. So anyway, yeah, what I was talking about with the union leadership, just watch 5 years from now. You won't see members of the Gambino family running the baseball union, but you will see people like Susan Rice being connected, lawyer types like Kamala Harris. Just watch. It'll be lefty lawyers that are in union leadership positions in the Major League Baseball Players Association, especially as they grab onto the minor leagues. Not rocket science, folks. These people love unions because unions support them. Okay. Well, despite the fact that they tried about 3 different launch days and times, the Artemis rocket still sits on the launch pad at NASA in Cape Canaveral, Florida. The cool thing is that I can see it on my nightly paddle tours. I can take pictures, such as they are, of the rocket illuminated quite brightly on the pad. I can tell paddlers that it's the most powerful rocket we have ever sent. Tidbits about NASA history and why this is unmanned. I can tell about the 5 or 6 launches I have seen just this summer from the Indian River Lagoon area. And I can point to 2 different launch pads and takeoff trajectories. But all I can really say about Artemis 1 is that it's still on the launch pad. The next window is probably late in September, and that the most likely launch will happen in October. Yeah, sigh, loud sigh. As Alan Shepard's character said in The Right Stuff, let's light this candle. Now, the problem appears to be multiple leaks in the fuel system. And yes, it's much better to be safe than sorry. You have to see it from where I can see it. The possibilities of what could happen throughout that area in the event of a major launch catastrophe, they are, well, let's just say catastrophic. I mean, it's, you know, if that thing takes up and it's, you know, 30 seconds into takeoff and something blows, it's over a bunch of people, folks. So, yeah, they want to be darn good and sure. Still, it's unmanned. There are no manned Artemis missions planned until 2025. So, yes, let's light this candle. Before we go to break, here's another internet laughy. CDC warns of new stealth COVID variant where you test negative and get no symptoms. Good stuff. We are going to go to break, and then I'm going to come back, and it's going to be college football time with Indy Hawk and Hawkeye Mike, who are both, well, Indy hasn't dialed in yet, but he's in the chat room, and he will be coming in. In the meantime, let's listen to some music while I take a break. Get ready for our college football talk.
My, what a marvelous time. Wear your patent leather shoes. You gotta win and never lose. Oh, and why, oh, why? Oh, Jack, I cry. Give it up and see you today. Why, such a glorious guy? Easy friends or easy foe? Ooh, you never know. Oh, and my, oh, my. Oh, Jack, you'll die.
Play fake. Beathard sets up deep in the pocket. Goes down the field for Smith.
And those days are so far removed from the mind of any Hawkeye fan. Indy Hawk, you there?
I'm here. How you doing, Hank?
Good, sir. How are you?
I'm well.
Good. Mike, you there?
I'm here, Hank. How are you?
I'm okay. Just listening to that. That's so far removed from anyone's brain.
I wish you had CJ Beathard back.
Oh, my gosh. I wish we had Bobby Beathard on our team. I mean, I don't even know where to start, so let's just get there. Let's just start somehow. Our first full week of college football is under the belt. We got it done, so let's start non-Big Ten. Indy, which non-Big Ten games or moments stood out to you over the weekend? Anything in particular?
I thought that Ohio State-Notre Dame game was interesting, especially just the way the game played out, where it was kind of a slugfest, you know, not a typical game. Ohio State, you know, typically Ohio State tries to outgun people. I know Ryan Day said after that game that was a good test for us to win an ugly game like that. I actually didn't watch the end of it, but I know Notre Dame showed me something there. I actually thought they would get blown out, as I said last week, but good game, but a good win for Ohio State.
Did you back up the truck, as you said?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Not back up the truck, but I did lose a little.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, it happens. Any other stuff? Any other games or moments, plays or anything, players?
It's going to be interesting. Michigan had an easy walk, but it's interesting that they got the J.J. McCarthy and McConnell, the other quarterback. He's going to alternate them. So they got a five-star quarterback. It's just McCarthy's second year.
Yeah,
great player. He's back up last year. Now this year he's going to start the next game, I think. That's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. He says he can win the national championship with either one of them, I believe.
You're talking about at Michigan?
Yeah, Michigan.
Yeah. Is it Cade McNamara or?
Yeah, McNamara is a starter. He
right.
was a starter last year.
Right. Like anything for you? Sorry, go ahead. Continue, Indy.
USC showed some strength. That's going to be interesting to watch USC, is what he does with that team.
Who did they play? I know it was some.
Oh, it was a cakewalk, Rice.
Oh, Rice. Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess you can't really look at that and say, oh, boy, how dominant. But it was a big win. Mike, how about you? Anything you saw that jumped out?
Yeah, it looks to me like the SEC is looking pretty good. I really thought that Georgia-Oregon game could be a good game, but man, Georgia manhandled them, 49-3 or something like that.
Yeah.
Georgia doesn't appear anyway to have lost a beat, and that's a tough first game, so they look really good. And then also Florida got I guess it was a slight upset over Utah.
Unranked over number 7 ranked.
Exactly. And then one drawback, I guess, was LSU not quite there yet, lost to Florida State. So, but I think the Pac-12, maybe Southern Cal's looking strong. They're practically almost mentally out of the Pac-12 and in the Big Ten now. But I think those were tough losses there for Oregon and Utah, who are supposedly the cream of the Pac-12.
Yeah, Georgia absolutely crushed Oregon.
Did you see the press conference after the LSU game where he said if you guys would come in on reporters were coming in late.
Yeah.
The reporters said, why don't you start winning a few games? Maybe we'll be on time.
Oh, God.
Brutal.
And she's walked it back and said she was unprofessional for saying that, but I don't care. I think it's funny.
It's still funny, though.
You know,
she
used to write about the Hawks for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, by the way.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. Georgia absolutely crushed them. Houston actually won at UTSA. We talked about UTSA last week briefly, but Houston is, you know, a ranked team, and they actually had to get a two-pointer in the third overtime. And then did anyone see about that Appalachian State-North Carolina game? What happened there?
I didn't.
Like North Carolina was up 41-21 going into the fourth quarter, and they ended up winning 63-61 in regulation. I mean, it was like
regulation.
Yeah. I mean, it was just like touchdown after touchdown. Appalachian State went for an onside kick. North Carolina returned it for a touchdown with like 33 seconds left, and then with 7 seconds left, I think it was. Appalachian State scored and then they missed on a two-point conversion to tie it. But, I mean, it was just – it was
crazy.
Literally – it was like watching Big 12 football back in the day. So, and yeah, and LSU losing the way they did.
Texas A&M is going to be an interesting team to watch. Speaking of the SEC, they – I believe it was 8 5-star recruits, the best recruiting class since they've been keeping track of it. So they had an easy game, 31-0, but I look for them to – it's going to be real interesting when they get Georgia, Alabama, and those guys, see who comes out of that, those three.
Yeah, well, the difference being, of course, Georgia's in the, Georgia may not have to play them in the regular season. I don't even know, but, you know, because they're East versus the West. Yeah, it would have to be in the championship for them. So, yeah, I just – I think the ACC was rather quiet other than, you know, Florida State got their win and the North Carolina game. Another Clemson got a big win, but nobody really talked about it. Another one, Syracuse
and Pitt had a win about a week in the
yeah.
You know, they played the week before and they had a good
right
win.
That backyard brawl
West
with
Virginia.
West Virginia, but Louisville, you know, you think of them as being reasonably okay, but Syracuse just took them, it just slapped them around. I mean, that's so. You know, the ACC is just—it's just hard to see what's going to happen there. I mean. You know, they just seem to be the quietest in terms of right now how things are shaking out. Anybody watch the Iowa State game since we got them this week?
I didn't watch it, but I was getting almost a play-by-play rundown from my brother, who's a huge Iowa State. Seemed to be pretty happy with how they played.
Okay, well, let's move on to Hawkeye thoughts. But these first four questions that I'm going to ask, two each. Hold off on any quarterback comments, okay? Okay, there's a reason for it. We'll get to that. So, Mike, other than the quarterback, what was the most disappointing thing for you in the game last Saturday? The single most disappointing thing?
I think it's pretty easy. The offensive line.
Okay.
Got to get. I was hoping they'd be better, and they struggled. And you know, I was reading or I heard Ferentz in his press conference was saying that something effective. We've got a lot of these guys played last year, but they're all four out of the five of them are in different positions. Well, maybe that's true, but they need to get in gear and we need to see vast improvement this week.
So you would say they were the most I would say that's the most surprising in its ineptness. I really expected
possibly, you know, and like you said, we'll leave Petras for a little later.
Right.
Probably, in my mind, maybe even more of a problem than Petras.
Yeah, exactly. Andy, two questions for you. What's the first thing you would change besides the quarterback? What's the first thing you would change if you're the coach?
Boy, I don't know. It's really hard with the – it was disappointing in the offensive line. The story of this Hawkeye Mike nail it just – gosh, that's kind of been our staple for a couple of decades, but
yep,
for longer.
Absolutely.
But I looked at it finally. The hurt let off enough where I could look at who actually we have, and we do. You know, we got a new center. He's making all the line calls, and a true freshman, and a sophomore, starting. Bo Stevens and Connor Colby's the other one. So maybe there's hope. But that they got to put that together. But we've looked bad, and I picked the game last week by 3 points, so I didn't feel good about it at all. Especially when it's a really good Division II. But you know that we've made a big step in Week 2 before. We'll just have to see.
So, in your opinion,
I think one caveat, Hank, I would throw into. I think that there is a large amount of room and for the offensive line to improve, and that they will, which is different from I think the current occupant of the quarterback position.
Okay, so again, right now, leaving the quarterback out, is it scheme or execution, or is it both? I mean, Andy, would you say it's scheme or execution if you had to pick one, or would you just say no, it's both?
I would say it's more execution. And I know people are all over the scheme, but you know, we're a run first team. It's kind of our, I mean, you look at Georgia, you know, they just dominate the line of scrimmage. You know, they don't run, you know, they don't throw the ball 50 times, you know, they're running, you know, out of the shotgun all the time. But so, it's kind of a, you know, we have to control the ball. And the big thing with, you know, I believe that the quarterback has to be accurate, because I'd like to see a stat on how many times I was going to be in a lot of third and shorts, and you got to pick those up. You got to make that easy throw, third and three, like Brady does. You got to get that.
And
boy, he was just awful. It wasn't even like Petrus. Yep. I'm jumping ahead, but I know Petrus. We weren't even throwing the ball downfield that far. I mean, a lot of short throws he just missed.
Yep. So, okay, Mike, to you, the depth chart looks bleak again this week. But so you're the coach. How would you adjust, knowing what, I mean, Keegan Johnson is still out. It looks like now Justin Jacobs is not going to play. You know, we definitely don't have, you know, some of our line, David Davidkoff, Justin Britt. I mean, how would you adjust? Would you adjust the play calling, or would you adjust personnel? I mean, if there are specific play, like if there's a specific play, what would, I don't know. How would you adjust? What would be your first way of adjusting? I mean, and I'm asking for a friend, as they say.
Well, you know, I think the one of the problems we saw again, which was all too common last year, was having that blow up play on either a first or a second down, which would put us behind the eight ball. I mean, Iowa is just never going to function well on a third and 12 or something like that. And we get into that situation, or second and 15 or something. We get into that situation way too much. And I mean, if you're asking me, what would I do? I would try to throw the ball short and quick more on first down, and try to get, because what's happening, South Dakota State did this, and other teams will do this, and it happened last year, is that we're just going to get continual basically stacking of the line, you know, stacking the box. And that will, you know, and why not? Because we haven't shown the ability to be able to throw the ball quick and force them back. And until we get better at that, and like Indy Hawks, you know, said that I think they were trying to do that. But particularly in the first quarter, Petrus was just missing wide open people on short throws with just terrible throws. And I mean, that just puts you behind the eight ball then, even if you just throw an incomplete pass, you know, all of a sudden you're second and 10. But I think we have to be able to throw more on first down in order to make the run work, because right now all the defenses are going to be stacking the line, you know, 8 men in the box, and until we can make them pay the price for that, it's going to continue, and it's going to hamper our running game.
Is there any play you saw that you hope they run again? Like a play that didn't work? Is there a play you saw that didn't work that you got, you know, that will work if that would work? If that works, that would be a great play.
And the thing that leaped out, and it might have changed the whole dynamic of the game, because I think again it was the early in the second quarter. We had a perfectly set up screen pass. This is another, it's just the way you want it. We were on about the 35, I think, of South Dakota State, and he just overthrew him, and he was, you know, they had the interference out there. There was really hardly anyone out. It would have worked perfectly. I don't know why. I don't recall that we tried to do that again, but that play was a big miss. I mean, that was the biggest miss of the entire game offensively.
Yeah, I'd agree. That was woeful. Andy, what's the one thing that would restore your confidence in the team? We're still pre-quarterback now. What's the one thing you could see against Iowa State that would restore your confidence in the team?
I think the offensive line making a move. I mean, you know, putting it together. So, I mean, it's disappointing. I think I said at the end of last year, just watch film all summer. Make those guys watch film just how bad the O-line play was. But they've got some talent there, but some of the guys that were bad last year are back. You would hope they're better.
Yeah.
But, you know, Iowa State plays this 3-3-5. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how we handle that. We haven't had a lot of problems with it in other years, but just three linemen and then three linebackers and five D-backs. So it's a kind of a – they got to be on top of it. Somebody's coming and, you know, somebody's not. But
yeah.
So that'll be another test for them. But we, you know,
I mean,
we've
you
done
said
it before.
So if you're the coaching staff, other than watching film, how do you bolster their confidence? I mean, if you're the O-line coach or Kirk Ferentz or whoever, how do you bolster the team confidence right now? How would you do it?
Well, you know, I would be into them pretty raw. I mean, as far as, you know, we're better than this. But what about the other side?
Yep.
Can you imagine Iowa State watching that game film? How are they going to think they're not going to come out and beat us by 40? I mean,
Can I chime in on that one?
Absolutely.
They might think that. They would be wrong because they may well win the game Saturday. They're going to win by 40 because the bright side, and it's really a shame, is I think our defense looks very good. And,
yeah, very good.
You know, as woeful as the offense was, we were never really I never felt in danger of losing for the simple reason that South Dakota State just could not do anything. And also
yeah.
Torrey Taylor played a big, you know, we were continually, you know, pushing him back inside the 20, often inside the 10 on punts. And you might, and it's no fluke because we were doing it last year too. The Penn State game sticks out. It's just a great defensive effort combined
yeah.
with great special teams, which makes it even more of a shame that we can't get our offensive output up a little bit, because if we have any
yeah.
kind, just an adequate offense, we could be very good.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No, I would agree. You know, you mentioned it, Indy, you mentioned watching film, but I have a feeling they are watching film, but it's on one of those things from like elementary school where they had to pull the reel out and then it would slip off and the teacher would have to reload it. That's what I think
yeah.
is happening. I think we are watching it on one of those, and so that's why we're just not taking, you know, okay, now we're going to hit it. Mike, we'll start with you. How much will a change at quarterback make a difference, do you think?
I've kind of come to the conclusion, and I'm at a loss almost, that I don't think, you know, the Ferentz is just – I was stunned when they didn't put Padilla in to start the second half. I really was. But he's made it clear that he's not going to make a change, at least now. I think we're going to actually probably have to lose a game before Ferentz would rethink that. He's just invested in – Petrus, I think he's, you know, Kirk's always so, you know, ball, you know, protecting the ball, although that was an awful interception that Petrus threw. But he thinks with Petrus in, I mean, this is the only thing I can come up with that makes any sense, that he's less likely to cause a mistake that's gonna cost the team. But it actually led to the only 3 points South Dakota State had.
Yeah.
And South Dakota State, I don't, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, once or twice they passed the 50-yard line. That was about it. And this
yeah.
is, and let me say this. I mean, we can you know, criticize the offense and justifiably so, and Petrus justifiably so, and I'll go right back to that. But I think South Dakota State is a good team. And, you know, it's easy to kind of brush off these FCS teams, but we all remember what happened in 2016 with North Dakota State.
Yep.
I don't know if they're North Dakota State, but they're maybe pretty darn close, and they're number
yeah.
two in FCS. And
yeah.
I was as disappointed as I was in the offense, I was really and especially when the offense is doing nothing, to see the defense
yeah.
do what they did and scoring points
Yeah.
You know, scoring points.
I mean,
and
tied
you
for
know.
Second in scoring. We have a linebacker and a defensive end tied for second on the team in scoring. I mean, you think about that.
But as good as the defense is, if the offense can't get its act together, the defense can't do it all.
Yeah, and they can't do it if we keep doing three and outs and stuff like that. Indy, I mean,
right.
In a slightly modified version of that question, when I say how much will a change of quarterback make a difference, that's assuming we don't change anything else. How much do you think? I mean, do you think it makes a difference if we bring in Joey Labus or Padilla or whoever? Do you think a quarterback change makes that much difference, everything else being equal?
Yeah, I didn't see that much from Padilla last year. I know some people did, but, I mean, I don't think he's that much better than Petras. But Labus, one of the things I hope they do is, you know, he's a run pass. I hope they put in a couple packages. I think they probably will at some point. Maybe not. Put him in and, you know, let him do a, you know, kind of a wildcat with a pass option. Let him run some of that stuff. I mean, they're not going to show that till the Big Ten, but. That's one thing to kind of get him involved a little bit. But, we are a team. And Ferentz, I read an article that he is very risk-averse, like incredibly risk-averse.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, if the guy, especially with this defense, is probably going to get worse as far as he's not going to take any chances. He doesn't want any but no turnovers. If we just, you know, punt it down there. It's funny. I was reading an article.
Yeah.
I Googled, like, was that a record for punts? We punted, I think, 10, 11 times, and they punted 10 times.
Yeah.
In 1939,
that's right.
The record is 77 punts. The teams would punt on first down.
Well,
I mean,
don't forget, I think, Niall Kinnick had, I think, 11 punts against Notre Dame.
Exactly. That may work for us.
I'm pretty sure Niall Kinnick had 11 punts against Notre Dame in 1939. As an example,
yep. there were 22 punts in a row in one game.
But his punting in that game helped win him the Heisman. You know, they talk about how several times against Notre Dame and against Minnesota, he killed potential drives with his punting. So if Torrey Taylor could just like throw a couple passes off a fake punt for touchdowns, he's got a shot at the Heisman, you know? I mean, it's a good shot.
You know, can I say one thing too in defense of Padilla a little bit? And by the way, I think the guy is by no means, a panacea, the complete answer at all. He was in the 3-0 in the three games he started last year. I would point that out. I think he's got a little bit of accuracy issues. If you look at his overall passing percentage, it was like around 50%, maybe even like 48
41.
Or something like that.
41.
Yeah, was it that bad?
41.
Well, the one thing that he does, and the one thing with an offensive line that's not up to snuff, is you need a quarterback with some mobility, and maybe Labus can do that. But Padilla's got more mobility and can move around in and out of the pocket.
He took, and
with Petras, it's just it's all over. You know, if he gets
but
any
for,
pressure.
But for average, he took the same number of sacks as Petras, and guess what? His long run was 6 yards. Hell, Petras has a long of 9 yards. I mean, I'm not knocking Padilla either. I don't think it's not his fault per se. I just think. I'm not sure that we have much. We kind of know what we have with Padilla. I think he's a good, solid. If Petras or whoever your starter is gets injured, I mean that's where he. That, I think that's the extent of it. I just think, I'm not looking for Cam Newton or a Vince Young type. I mean, I'm not looking for a guy who's always looking to run, but what made Beathard and what made Tate and what made Brad Banks was their ability to extend plays. It's simple as that. I mean,
right. Well, why I do think, and I let me agree with you then. I mean, because like I said, the guy's no panacea and he was 3-0 as a starter. I will point that out, including a big win over the Minnesota, I do think Labus is probably the quarterback of the future, and it's going to be a little rocky because he's got no playing experience if you put him in. But maybe we need to do that and to get him going with getting his playing legs going and getting him, you know, into the heat of the moment and knowing that, you know, it might take a game or two to get him going, but we're talking about a quarterback position right now that I mean, Petras, he is what he is. It's his third year. He's not going to get better. And, you know, the one hope right. was if you with an offensive line giving him great protection, that he can be functional. But without great protection, he's just a bust. So given the offensive line we have, and even hopeful that it will get better as the season goes along, we need some mobility at quarterback. And I think Levis is the quarterback, from everything I've read and heard, the quarterback of the future. And you know, but it's just not, you know, look how long it took before Ferentz made the change. He had to go through that disastrous 2014 season. Yep. Before he would put Beathard in. And the same thing even with Banks, if you remember. The yep. first year Banks was there, he put him in very little.
But Banks is on the record as saying multiple times he was not ready. He was not ready to be the starter. He didn't have a grasp on the playbook. He was not – I mean, he has said multiple times, no, he was not ready to be the starter. Now, I don't know if you can – you know, I don't know how seriously you take that, but you look at Stanzi. I mean, everybody, you know, is worried.
Right.
Stanzi as a redshirt sophomore had no starting experience, but he started our second
right.
game. That, you know, so they knew that it was there. And I think that there's two sides to it. One, do you really penalize your quarterback when your offensive line sucks? Now, you don't have to look at it as penalizing, but do you? I mean, it's not the quarterback's fault that the offensive line sucks. But by that same token,
right.
you know, when we were out of running backs in 2004, we passed a lot more. We became almost an exclusively, you know, pass first team. And so, you know, we do have to, that's when I think we have to make the adjustments. That's when I think it's really.
Now, one thing that we might be hopeful of for a little bit better offensive output is, A, it's the second game. A lot of times, that's the biggest improvement, game one and game two. I think Indy Hawk just touched on that a little bit. I do think the offensive line will get better. But also, we should have Gavin Williams back. And although it looks doubtful that we'll get either Reganey or Johnson back, it will help to have a little bit more depth at running back, I think. But you know, as thin as we are at wide receiver, and then losing Gavin Williams the last game, it did not help our offense to have our two best receivers out. And although I do think Arlen Bruce played a decent game, and then also having the preseason starter Gavin Williams out at running back. So if we can get, you know, if we can start getting these people back, that should help a little bit. But it's
I'm
fundamental.
Waiting for Brody
the offensive line's got it. Yeah, well, we didn't hear. We haven't heard. Is he hurt? Because we haven't heard much of him.
Who's
and
that?
I don't think he was showing up on the depth.
Brody
Breck. Brody
Breck.
I don't think he's scored like
five,
in the two 40, or three
six,
deep,
four.
He I believe he did get in for a play last weekend. If I remember looking at, yeah. you know, you can look at the player utilization. There's a place where you can find that. I believe he did get in for a play. It might have been special teams. I don't even know. But, I just think, we're going to have to do something different. I don't know what, but, I mean, you know, but that's it. You know, we're
right.
down. We're down Keegan Johnson. We're down Nico Reganey. You know, and who knows what's going on with Keegan. We don't know what's going on. You know, we don't know exactly where Justin Jacobs stands, other than he's not even appearing on the depth chart this week. You know, but that speaks to depth. I mean, why were we losing wide receivers in the transfer portal? Why weren't we going into the transfer portal for this? But again, you know, as Indy says, Kirk Ferentz is risk averse. He's also not a big fan of the transfer portal. Not to say he won't ever use it. You know, yeah. when you have a problem with how it's utilized, and you've seen how it's utilized by other schools, you tend not to want to utilize that same thing. I mean, you know, what did Charlie Jones go into Purdue? I mean, what are we going to find out later, that there are Purdue guys that get into the portal because they brought in Charlie Jones and Tyrone Tracy the way they did? I mean, you know, that's the thing. I mean, we've utilized it, but by the same token, I don't think Kirk likes the way that it's under its current format, and I think that he'll be careful about using it as such. But that's just that's
well. You
want to
hear a crazy stat? The
sure.
most wins for a team that has punted eight or more times since 2020.
Iowa
has won 6 games. Eight teams, next closest is 8 teams tied with 2.
Yeah.
Now, how can that happen?
Yeah. Well, you know, punting is winning.
Yeah, I mean, it's
punting is winning didn't just start this year. I mean, the meme punting is winning has been around for a couple of years now. So,
yeah.
So, I mean,
I wanted to ask you guys, going back to the defense real quick. I thought somebody that really looked outstanding. I thought Quinn Schulte looked really good.
Yeah, definitely
new starter. And but I also Terry Roberts. I mean, to me, he's like the. A little bit of Bob Sanders, kind of 2.0. He reminds me a little bit of him. I thought he played well too.
Oh yeah, I thought he played great. And I'm surprised that the guy that starts ahead of him, I'm forgetting who it is, Jamari Roberts is still not listed on the depth chart. Now he missed last Saturday because of an OWI off season, but you know I'm surprised that he's not even making it back onto the depth chart yet. So.
Schulte looked good. Schulte looked good, but that was the only offer he had was South Dakota State. I looked it up today just to see what his the disappointing thing to me was Xavier Wampa, you know, doesn't play and he plays on special teams, but I just don't understand. It goes to the conservative. You got to be in the program 2 years to be, you know, you look at the guys, AJ Epenesa, second team. 2 years in a row.
Well, but
in the rotation,
I thought Kirk
but,
said that.
But Epenesa played a lot.
I thought Ferentz said he was going to play, that Nwankwo would play a lot. So it's a little surprising that he wasn't in more.
I don't think he micromanages. You got to put some of that on Phil Parker. Phil Parker is calling the play-by-play stuff on the. You know, so that's.
That's a good point.
He came in early. He came in early from the summer. Because that free safety makes all the calls and the defenses and some of the coverages, you know, last minute. So he's knee deep in the play, but you know, he's not even in the 2 deep.
But I mean, you know, that's just it. And of course, you know, we also know that the 2 deep isn't necessarily set in stone. Other than when a guy gets pulled completely off it, who's been injured. I think that's pretty much clear.
He played zero snaps though. Wampa played zero snaps on D.
So let's get to our games last week and this week. So last week, Penn State at Purdue. I was the only one that picked Penn State. Thank you very much. We all picked Michigan State over Western Michigan. That's correct. I was the only one that picked Indiana over Illinois. You know,
that was a little surprising to me.
Yeah, it was surprising to me, even though I picked so. Yeah, we all picked Michigan. We all picked Iowa. We all picked Maryland and Rutgers, and we all picked Nebraska. We all picked Wisconsin, and we all picked OSU. For reasons I can't explain, I omitted the Minnesota game. But given who their opponent was and the result, let's assume we all went with the Gophers. In essence, though, I was the only one to pick them all correct due to my picks of Indiana and Penn State. So out of those games, did anybody watch? Mike, I know you were watching some of the Nebraska game.
Well, you know, that game was a real struggle for about 2.5 quarters, and then Nebraska was able to pull away and kind of, you know, get the easy win at the end. And they needed it, boy. That was their first win in, what, eight or nine games, something like that. And it stays good for them because I think they've got Georgia Southern this Saturday.
Yeah.
So they should get to 2-1. But if they had dropped that North Dakota game, and it looked like it might go either way for a while, what would have happened? I don't know. But they kind of got their act together and won. I mean, my God, no, North Dakota, right? I think we're not talking North Dakota State now. North Dakota,
right. Exactly.
It will be interesting. I like to see how South Dakota State does the rest of the year. Because if they have a good season and their offense looks good in other games, that just emphasizes the how good the Iowa defense is again. But anyway. Yeah, so, you know, Nebraska, I guess they righted the ship a little bit, and they needed a win as bad as anybody I can think of.
Yeah, definitely needed it. So let's go to this week's games. Andy, I'll let you pick first. Arkansas at Ohio State. Or Arkansas looks to be
State,
pretty good.
It?
Arkansas,
no, it's Arkansas
State.
No, it's Arkansas State, I believe.
Oh, it is? I thought it was Arkansas. Let me double check then.
It's Arkansas State. Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
That's why he's winning Hawkeye, Mike. He's telling us the wrong opponents.
Yeah, well, you know.
I was going to say, that's a hell of a game. For a second, I was like, I didn't know that was. Because Arkansas is good, but I think it's Arkansas State.
Had a big win over Cincinnati.
Yeah, it's Arkansas.
That was a good
State.
Win for them.
Yeah, so let's go.
Ohio
let's,
State
let's,
all the way.
I'll go out on a limb on that one and go with Ohio State.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to double check and make sure that it's not
Can I say real quick, though, that Notre Dame did impress
me, Arkansas.
And that usually is not the case. Notre Dame played Ohio State tough, and I think they've got something. You know, Ohio State pulled away at the end, but it was a hard-fought win, and Notre Dame, keep their heads up high on that game.
Yeah. So, Andy, it is Arkansas State at OSU. So who are you picking?
OSU.
Okay. And, Mike, I assume OSU?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. I'm going to go with OSU as well. Okay. Western Illinois at Minnesota. Mike, you're up on this one.
Minnesota's looking pretty good to me. And Western Illinois is, I don't know too much about them, but I don't think they're going to stay with Minnesota. Minnesota's going to win.
Yeah.
Easily.
Andy?
Yeah, I'm going Minnesota easy.
Yeah. But what Western Illinois is, I believe, still FCS. So this should be a good one. Duke at Northwestern, Indy.
Yeah, I'm gonna go Northwestern.
Yeah. Mike, how about
I
you?
Like Fitzgerald.
Yeah, Northwestern showed a lot of grit in that game against Nebraska, and I think they got a good team. They're maybe not great, but I think they're a solid team, and so I'm going with Northwestern.
Okay. Yeah, Duke. I'm trying to think of what Duke like. They had a win, but I don't remember who they play. Oh, Temple. 30-0 over Temple, and I don't know how good Temple is recently. But yeah, I'm going to go with the Cats as well. I think Fitz gets it done, and he's just a good coach. I mean, I know a lot of Hawkeye fans don't like him. They think he's Iowa centric, but I think he also he wants to emulate some of the successes that Kirk Ferentz had. So, Ohio University at Penn State, Mike.
Penn State showed me something in that win over Purdue. I did pick Purdue. I thought it would be close. It was close. Penn State, on the road, and they came back and won. I thought that was a real good win for them. They looked good because I think Purdue is good. But Penn State will win easily this game.
Okay. Andy, how about you?
I'm going Penn State. They'll take care of business.
Yeah. Okay. And then Andy, you're up first on this one. Washington State at Wisconsin.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Washington State's a huge underdog on this one, about, I think, 18.5.
Okay.
So I look at Washington. I'm sorry. Wisconsin.
And Mike?
Yeah, Wisconsin. I think they're not going to lose at home.
Yeah, and Washington State has fallen off in recent years, I know. So they're not the team that they kind of were for a portion. Maryland at Charlotte. I don't know why Maryland's doing that, but this will go to you.
Okay. Yeah, Maryland, I think Maryland's not a bad team, and I don't know anything about Charlotte. I can't believe they're any good. Maryland.
Okay, Indy.
I'm going Maryland. Does Charlotte still have Cedric Maxwell? Is that the same school?
UNC Charlotte. I don't know if it's the same, if it's UNC Charlotte or not.
I thought they changed their name. Maybe that's wrong.
Yeah, there's a couple of them that have done that. I mean, the Missouri schools have done that. The Louisiana schools have done that. Let me see what we can find out on Charlotte and Maryland. Why do I have Maryland? That's I'm looking at last week's games. I was looking at last week's game to see what Duke did. So, Charlotte, let's see if they were what their status is. What the deal is on them? I know this. They're 0-2, so it doesn't really matter. I mean, I think they're toast. So I'm going to go agree and go with Maryland. Akron at Michigan State. Indy to you.
Michigan State.
Mike.
Yeah, I got to go Michigan State. I don't think the Zips are quite up to it.
Yeah, I would agree. So I'm going to go with Michigan State, of course, as well. This is a good one. It depends on how much you guys are willing to fall on the sword at this point. But Virginia at Illinois. Indy, Mike, we're starting with you.
You know, I'm going to sound like I'm picking up the slack up for Brother Tom here, but a tough loss for Illinois. They didn't play bad against Indiana. I think Illinois is going to – it won't be easy, but it's at – if it was at Virginia, I'd go Virginia. It's at Illinois. I'm going to go with Illinois.
And Indy?
I'll go Illinois by a field goal.
Yeah. I just don't know. I mean – Virginia's got a win over Richmond, so, you know, hard to say. Gosh, I don't know. I guess I'm going to be contrarian here. I'm going to go with UVA because I think they got, you know, Illinois got them there last year, so I think it's Indiana. So you're starting this one, Indiana State at Purdue.
Purdue, big.
Mike?
Yeah, Purdue bounces back. They'll win big over Illinois State.
Yeah.
I mean, Indiana State. Yeah.
I got to agree. I'm going there. So we're all the same except for me being the only one that picked UVA. Wagner at Rutgers. Mike?
Well, you know, Rutgers had a good win last week up at BC, and I think they keep it going over Wagner.
Yeah. Indy?
I go Rutgers. I guess should take care of business.
Yeah, agreed. I'm going to take Rutgers as well. But here we're getting good. Here's a good one. Georgia Southern, who, by the way, I think they play in that Sun Belt, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct? Georgia Southern, I believe, in the Sun Belt with, like, Appalachian State and – maybe Coastal Carolina. Let me double check here who we got in the Sun Belt.
I think that sounds right.
They might have been moved into, you know, they might have gone into Conference USA. No, they are in the Sun Belt. They are 1-0. They did win last week. Let's see who they beat. They beat Morgan State 59-7, so that's not an indication, but so let's do it. Okay, so Indy, you're up. Georgia Southern or Nebraska?
I go with Nebraska, but I won't be surprised.
Yeah, you know, it's hard to get too overconfident with picking Nebraska to win, but I think they'll handle Georgia Southern. I do think they'll win.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I gotta kind of agree in there. So I'll go with them. Hawaii at Michigan. Mike, you're up.
Yeah, Michigan's going to pull this one out, I think.
Indy?
I think Michigan wins and J.J. McCarthy emerges as the quarterback. He's getting the start, I believe.
He is.
Yeah, so
yeah, he is
we'll,
getting the start.
Will Cade McNamara go into the portal if McCarthy asserts himself?
Well, could,
I think
can
that's
he?
Trying,
I'm not
what
even
he's
sure.
trying to avoid.
Right, I think that's why he's trying to avoid that. But, I mean, if McCarthy becomes sort of the irresistible force that becomes the starter, and then maybe that won't happen, but I kind of thought maybe that's what Indy Hawk was hinting at, what happens with McNamara. Right,
well,
I think that's the only reason why. Normally you wouldn't want to alternate like that, but I think he's trying to have his cake and eat it too.
Is there a cutoff for the portal? Like, can you go in midseason?
I don't know.
You could get you could get an exemption. I'm not sure that you know, I'm pretty sure that, you know, Michigan wouldn't sign off on that.
Right.
But here's the thing. Michigan's quarterback, our Michigan's roster lists 9 quarterbacks. Now, four of them are freshmen, but still 9 quarterbacks listed on their roster. So I'm not sure, you know, that Cade McNamara wouldn't be a loss, obviously. He would be a loss if he left, but I don't think it matters because I don't think they're going to allow – they would sign off on him leaving in midseason. So it's a moot point. Indy, Idaho at Indiana.
Hoosiers make it 2 in a row.
And Mike.
Yep, Indiana's going to win.
Yeah, got to agree, got to agree. Okay, so here's a question. Here's a follow-up. We've talked about our quarterback, et cetera. But let's get back to the offensive line. Here's what's not clear. We only played, supposedly only 6 guys played on the line rotation. We didn't rotate like 8 guys in or anything like that. Only 6 guys from what I understand. Now, I could be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure I read a couple places that it was 6 guys. Do you think we're going to see, what happens first? Guys going back to original positions, do you think? Or are we going to see some changes in personnel? I mean, Andy, what do you think?
I think they'll stay pretty close to where they were, maybe different combinations, you know, guys sliding tackle or guard or something like that. But
yeah.
I think it's going to be more, you know, making the reads, the zone blocking. You know, I'd love to know more about what makes Iowa's scheme so hard to pick up. We always seem to start slow, and then we pick up momentum. I think it's zone blocking.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot of confusion. I think maybe having the center with a week to go back and look at, you know, Logan Jones, the new center, go back
yeah.
and look at, you know, the line calls and all that. But this it'll be if that's an issue for us, Iowa State, you know, that 3-3-5 is a unique defense. You know, you don't see that a lot, so that could bring some interesting complications if that's our issue. But we've handled that in the past. I think, you know, we've got more talent, so I think we can hopefully get the running game going, establish that, and, you know, just beat them up front.
Yeah. Okay, so we got to pick this game then. Mike, you're up first. Yeah. Iowa State at Iowa. Who are you going with?
Well, let me say this. I'm gonna pick Iowa. I'm not going to go against Iowa here, but, you know, just can't do it sort of. Iowa obviously is going to have to pick their game up to beat Iowa State. I think Iowa State had a pretty good first game, and, you know, they were a little bit of a question mark. And, of course, I don't know that this opponent that they beat, Missouri State, Southeast Missouri State, how good they are, but I suspect not very. But this new quarterback, Deckers, seems to be pretty good. And I have confidence, though. I think the Iowa defense is going to find a way to help Iowa get just enough on offense to win. And the Hawks are going to win 17-10.
Okay. And Indy?
Yeah, I'm thinking along the same lines, low-scoring game. I think we, you know, we patch up some holes. Defense dominates, you know, first year quarterback.
Yep.
And I would not want to be facing our defense. We're loaded. And I think they've got a lot of reason to, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how they respond. I mean, they could look like crap. They play like they did last week. I think they
right.
lose the game.
Right.
But
I agree.
You know, Jack Campbell has, you know, he had some great words, you know, like, hey, we got their back, they got our back, talking about the offense. So, you know,
yeah.
when a team is getting beat up like that and they're reading the papers and they're just, you guys are horrible, sometimes they come together. I think Iowa wins and handles them again. But
and one thing I want to point out, too, just real quick, that Iowa has had the advantage, I think this will happen, is there's going to be a turnover or two by Iowa State that Iowa will use on a short field to get a score or two out of. And that'll prove to be the difference, I think. And that's kind of been the way it's gone in the, you know, Iowa's dominated the series the last 7 in a row, I think. or six in a row.
Well, Campbell runs that offense.
Right. And it's usually because Iowa State usually has not been able to protect the ball very well against Iowa. I think it's going to be at Kinnick. The crowd will be right behind Iowa. I think Iowa's going to get a key turnover or two, and that's going to propel them to the win.
Anybody remember our last turnover against Iowa State? The one that we last committed, the last turnover we lost against Iowa State?
I do not.
I remember
their last one.
It was Jordan Canzeri fumbled inside the 20 in 2015. That is the last time we turned the ball over against Iowa State.
And we still overcame that turnover and won. Yep.
It was tied at that point. Yeah, it was tied at that point, and we got a great punt return from Desmond King after that, and got us out. And then Beathard threw that pass to McCarron, that absolute rope to McCarron. But you know that was the last time we turned the ball over against them. So yeah, I kind of think that we didn't. That fumble last week by LaShawn Williams wasn't
LaShawn,
the best.
LaShawn Williams, yeah.
Yeah.
That was the one drive Iowa had where the offense, looked semi-acceptable, if you call. They had a long drive there, a couple big passes, some good runs, and it looked like we were going in, and then that fumble. And that fumble, I think, was at the end of about a 7-yard run down to the 4-yard line or something like that.
Yeah. He got the ball picked, pulled out.
Right.
You know, which is not the most comforting. I mean,
they had a wide open touchdown they missed. They had a guy in behind, our defense, and they just overthrew him. That was a touchdown.
Right.
If he just gets it close.
Right.
Big break there.
Yeah.
We got lucky on that one. That was just that one play, really.
Yeah, we did. I think Indy, you said that we didn't go downfield at all. Like one time that you could have called it downfield, and that 15
right.
yards or 20 yards isn't really downfield. I mean, I did not see any plays where we seemed to be looking at a deep ball, a really deep ball. I think that's
the key, Hank, because we didn't even look for it. It's not like we wanted to, but the protection wasn't there. I didn't see one scheme of a pass. We threw a couple, 20, 25 yarders, if you recall, in that drive where we ended up fumbling. But nothing, there was nothing that was really unleashed downfield, which even appeared to be designed to do that. So that's another head scratcher to me.
I think they were trying to get him, some short throws, give him some confidence, but man, he was off as much as I've ever seen him, Petrus.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was.
Looked like Fauci out there.
But he didn't have any symptoms. Yeah, I don't know what it is because it's his third year now as the starter, second with a full off season. In other words, no COVID interruption, nothing like that. He is working behind a new line, but that should be the line's problem, not his. I mean, he should know what he's working with. I don't know. I'm at a loss to explain it. I don't know if it's, T. Bodie said something in the chat room about, those other guys were game day guys, Beathard, Banks, Tate, et cetera. They were game day quarterbacks, but, I can't imagine that he looks so great in practice that they can sit there and say, this is not even a competition or it's not even a question. Obviously guys are off limits. I think, a reporter's not going to grant a one-on-one private interview for, is going to be granted a one-on-one private interview for Alex Padilla or Joey Labus or whatever. But by the same token, I can't believe nobody's asking him the questions like, hey, at what point do you go with a different guy? And here's another thing. Indy, I would start with you. What are your thoughts? Why not go under a two-quarterback system for a while?
I think it's the risk thing. I mean, explain to me how, Brad Banks, he made a big jump. He's got a lot of talent. AJ Epenesa, yeah, he's getting snaps, about 40% of them. And he goes to I think he made some All-America teams as a backup. I forget the guy's name that, you know, he didn't even get drafted as a defensive end that was ahead of him.
He's playing in the NFL right now. That kid is playing in the NFL right now. Parker Hesse. It was Parker Hesse who's playing in the NFL.
Not as a defensive end, as a tight end.
But as Hank's brother Tom points out, look how long it took to get for Ferentz to get off of Christensen and get Stanzian. I mean,
Christensen had 1 year as a starter, and if you'll remember, in that year, that was 2007, Stanzi had very limited exposure against Syracuse, and he didn't look all that great. Arvell Nelson was given the keys. He was given the reins before I believe it was the Northwestern game. He promptly was late for practices and team meetings, and I believe missed a bus ride, either to the airport or to a hotel or wherever. Literally, he was given the keys to the kingdom and blew it, completely blew it. So, you know, it's not to think that maybe other guys haven't had the shot. I mean, one of the knocks on Dan McGuire, remember from back in 1987, he was given the initial starting nod, but he got sick before his first start. He was, from what I understand, puking in the locker room and was so nervous, couldn't handle the pressure. So, you know, we could be dealing with that kind of issue. I don't know. I mean, Christensen certainly didn't lack for confidence, I didn't think.
Not,
you know,
for 40
Stanley
years,
proved,
I mean,
he just couldn't make a throw
behind for a year. He starts a year, and he's All-American, or, you know, All-America mention. He goes all the way back to, you know, Chuck Long, Tom Grogan. You can't tell the difference between them, Hayden. Grogan wins the job. I think we lost to Iowa State that year.
Actually,
Long
did get that first start against
Grogan
Nebraska.
Got the second.
Yeah, Grogan
That's
got
an 82.
The second.
Yeah.
So, you know, that was
–
how
do you not see the difference between those two? I mean, seriously. It just doesn't give me confidence.
That's coach speak. That's one thing Kirk Ferentz learned from Hayden Fry is there's no reason to tell the media anything because the media won't – the one thing you can trust the media to do is not do the right thing with any information you give them, whether it's sports media or news media. I don't care. I mean, you know, watch Dave Wannstedt, you know, with stuff he says, you know, so – Go ahead.
Look at the true freshman playing on Georgia and everybody else.
Last year, Ferentz was in several games made the move at the half to put in Padilla, and when you saw how things went in the first half last week, I don't understand why you know you could put Padilla in maybe he wouldn't have done any better. I don't see how he could have done worse. And I don't understand why, you know, Padilla's, he's not a greenhorn. He's had plenty of game experience. Why wouldn't he have at least given him a shot? I just don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't either. Because it's not like, it's not like how Spencer Petras looked. It's not like you could throw it all at the feet of the offensive line. Because he did have time on some throws, not a lot, maybe.
Right,
but you know what?
Right.
What quarterback is guaranteed 5 seconds to throw the ball anyway? Nobody is. So, yeah, that's just a wrong argument. You know, it's two sides to it because you really can't blame a lot of it on Spencer Petras, but that doesn't mean that changing quarterbacks doesn't change things. I mean, by all accounts, the move to Ricky Stanzi over Jake Christensen energized the team. You know, I mean, it completely energized the team. Now, again, Kirk Ferentz can't go by what the team thinks. I mean, if the team's favorite guy is Alex Padilla, if he's not the best quarterback, you don't start him. But that's not the point. The point is, you know, who gives us, and I have a hard time believing that any of the other quarterbacks don't give us the same chance to win a game. So,
right. Well, why not give it a try? That's my opinion. You know, why not put him in and see what he can do?
Yeah, well, as I said, why not go with a two-quarterback system for a while? It's not like you have to do a bunch of different stuff. It's just throw things off, you know? You bring in a Joey Labus as an example. Well, who's game plan for him? Who has any film on this guy? Nobody. Now, if he looks that bad in practice, I have a hard time believing that he does if Kirk has said he made such progress during bowl prep last year. So I'm lost. I'm dumbfounded by it. I really am. And I hope someday we hear what's going on. But, I mean, we're never even going to – I don't think we're ever going to find out what the injury has been to Keegan Johnson. So,
no.
You know?
But I would disagree a little bit on Petras that I think he did cost us. I mean, he's got to make those – you got to make those simple throws, especially in Iowa's offense. We're not going to blow – we're not going to have 80-yard touchdowns. We're going to – you got to get those third and twos, like I mentioned before. It's efficiency.
Right.
You got to make that layup
if you recall on that interception that he threw that led to the only point South Dakota State got, they had like a three and out, but they were at the Iowa 25 and got the field goal. If you recall, they ran the play, the replays, and two guys were open Petras could not make the check off to get it to him.
Well, he couldn't make the throw, but they say because he was in the, he had one guy draped around his leg. Well, then don't make the throw is my point. Just don't make the throw then.
Or throw it away, at worst, take
the sack, but otherwise throw it away, so you take a grounding call, worst things have happened, So that's my point.
He's throwing it away when guys are wide open. Why not throw it away when guys on your left?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, he doesn't do a very good job of checking off to the second and tertiary receivers.
I'm not sure he has the time to do that, right? At times. So,
well,
anyway,
that's a fair point, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. So, hey, I'm gonna close you guys off for the rest of this show because I've got a couple things I want to cover. But next week and go Hawks this Saturday and stuff. And thanks for being on. And I don't know. I'm just not sure what to think, but we'll see Saturday.
Let's go.
Okay. We'll talk to you guys later. Thanks, man. Bye.
Thanks, Hank.
Thanks, Hank.
Okay. As always, a great time with Hawkeye Mike and Indy Hawk. For Hawkeye fans, it's certainly some apprehension going into this weekend. So a couple final thoughts and remembrances. 21 years ago this coming Sunday, 9/11 took place, in which 19 hijackers took control of four U.S. airliners, crashed two of them into the Twin Towers, which eventually fell, one into the Pentagon, and then another was crashed into a field in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, after passengers revolted. We lost almost 50,000 Americans that day. And the sad thing is, a friend of mine who was on the show last year, Rich, who was at the January 6th event, talks about, with the way things have gone at the border, and they've talked about some of the people that have been captured at the border recently, you got to wonder if there's another 9/11 getting ready to take place. And I would never have said this under any other president, but under this president, could I see it happening? An intentional relaxation and a 9/11? Yeah, I could see it. I don't think this administration would stop at anything in an effort to gain complete and utter control of this country through martial law or whatever. So let's not forget, be thinking about that. 21 years ago, I know of two people that I knew that died in the towers. I hadn't been in touch or anything like that, but one I knew quite well growing up. Rest in peace, Andrew King. A good guy, a great athlete, and just a general all-around great guy. And most of his family, his parents are gone. He still has a brother and sister that are alive and some cousins. But, it's changed their lives forever. And 50 years ago, this past Sunday and Monday, or Monday and yesterday, Monday and Tuesday, the Munich Massacre took place at the 1972 Olympic Games in Munich, West Germany. Eight terrorists busted into some Israeli rooms, killed two Israeli team members and coaches, took nine as hostages, made several demands. The release of Andreas Baader and Ulrike Meinhof from the Baader-Meinhof gang. Isa was his name. His real name was Lutif Afif. He was their leader and negotiator. He demanded the release of 234 Palestinian prisoners, as well as, I said, Baader and Meinhof. They kept giving in on deadlines. They eventually settled for transportation to an air base at First and Feldbrook Airport. There was carnage, absolute carnage. The Israeli Mossad had been, Israel itself had asked permission to come in and help. They were denied by the West German government. Some of the West German negotiators, as well as Arab negotiators and others, offered to place themselves in the place of the hostages, telling the leaders that, hey, this is not good to happen at the Olympics, and it's really stupid to happen to athletes. Pointed out, Germany has gone through the Holocaust and Hitler, and maybe there's another way. They would not, the terrorists would not budge. So it went to First and Feldbrook. There was a team waiting in the airliner who abandoned it. There were no actual marksmen from the West German police or the Bavarian police, just some cops there, most of whom weren't actual marksmen at all. They were placed poorly around the tarmac. One of the helicopters landed in the wrong place and resulted in the deaths of the rest of the Israeli athletes and five Black September members. Three of them survived, Adnan Al-Ghashay, Jamal Al-Ghashay, and Mohammed Safadi. They were released a month later in a hostage exchange, which followed the hijacking of a Lufthansa flight. It turned out that was staged. The Israeli government came under fire eventually for Operation Wrath of God, which authorized Mossad to track down and kill anyone involved. But it's 50 years now. 50 years. And I hearken back to some movies that were made about this subject. A dramatization called 21 Hours at Munich. Also a documentary, One Day in September. There was also the movie Munich, Steven Spielberg's movie in 2005. It's hard to believe that in some ways we've come no further in terms of anti-Semitism, both in this country and worldwide. But more so that it's really not even talked about. This was ghastly, absolutely ghastly, what happened. And I for one, have trouble forgetting it. But I would hope that people would remember it, both this and 9/11, that under our current government, these bad people are beginning to thrive again, whether it be rapists or kidnappers who serve short sentences or are flat out released with no bail, or terrorists who would steal planes or kidnap athletes. This could still happen. So be vigilant. Stand up for morality, ethics. Don't let people forget. When people say the Holocaust was fake, call them out. When people say, well, Israel deserved what happened to it, call them out. This is wrong. The IOC at the time was wrong. Didn't even want to suspend the games. And I think of two people involved in the movie, One Day in September, Nuke Spitzer and her mother, Anki Spitzer. Their father, Andre Ray, her father and husband, was one of the ones killed and was one of the ones who was put in front of the window to talk to reporters or to negotiators at the time. I mean, there are kids who never met their parents that were killed in that. Anouk Spitzer, number one, and the daughter of Joseph Ramon. Joseph Romano. Never got to really meet their fathers or know their fathers. Think about that, and think about the evil that is in this world. We have to stand up to it. We cannot let this continue. We cannot let the Dopey Nostra continue. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. Be vigilant, be safe. pray hard and stand up for what is right. In the meantime, have a great weekend. Have a good week. It is Iowa State Week, otherwise known as Hate Week. But there are other good games going on as well. So have a great weekend. Have a great rest of the month. And we will be back next week at 5:30. Have a good night, folks. Have a good night and a pleasant tomorrow, as they say.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.